Welcome to Lit from the Basement. This is Danielle.
This is Max.
I'm an author and professor.
I was an officer with the Maine Forest Patrol, and after avenging the deaths of my family, I wandered into the wasteland to bring law to the lawless. Now, I'm a stay-at-home dad.
We're a married couple who discuss literature in our basement while our children are sleeping. Our show is pretty simple. I introduce Max, my poetry-resistant husband.
Heidi-ho.
To a poem which we use as a springboard for conversation in the 1 hour we have to ourselves in the evening.
The boys are now asleep.
So let's talk.
Okay. Hi, wife. Haven't seen you in a while. Feels like months.
2 months. We haven't been talking about these poems.
Or seeing each other.
Well, we haven't been away from our house for 2 months, away from one another. I just slipped into a vortex over the last 2 months, and we haven't been caring for our children together at all.
We just left them with a badger and let it raise them.
It was a very talented badger. Don't be afraid, those of you in the audience.
It's one of her students. Okay, well, this is going to be airing just before 4th of July. Do you got some Americana for us, or what do you got?
Yeah, actually, I have some Midwest Americana for us.
That's as cana as America can get.
Yes, it is. So today's poem is from Bruce Snyder's collection, Paradise, Indiana. So it's a poem a lot about Indiana, where we used to live very close to.
Yes. And I've been through Indiana a couple times, and I've been to Indiana.
Yeah, I was going to say, there are two, in my mind, memorable trips that we made to Indiana.
I know. Now I know what the... Oh, I know Gen Con.
Yes.
We went to Gen Con.
Yes.
And the other one is you gave a reading in Muncie.
Yay!
Yeah. I'm like, where's the other time? Oh, it's right. We went to Muncie.
No, Jill Christman and Mark Neely at Ball State had invited me to Muncie, Indiana to give a reading. And it was so close where we were living at the time, Cincinnati, that I brought Max along and I gave a reading. And I couldn't believe what a great job they did.
That was a great crowd,
too. That's what I mean. It was a great crowd. Like, this has nothing to do with me. Like, they just run a great show there. Like, we arrived at the town and we went to some random coffee shop to get some coffee. And there was a poster of me in there. Like, they didn't just advertise to, like, the students.
Like, I photographed you posing next to it. I'm like, look at this.
We're like, oh my gosh. Like, they just went all out in advertising it. So they had a huge crowd of people. I had never given a reading to such a large crowd.
It was like the David Letterman Auditorium.
Yeah, that's right. No, they did a great show. So, you know, if any of you writers out there are listening and you get invited to a reading at Ball State, you should totally go.
Ball State takes good care of you.
Yeah. So then you and I were joking forever that I was famous in Muncie, Indiana.
You are Muncie famous.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it had nothing to do with me. It just had to do with their great show. But the other trip was to Gen Con.
Oh yeah, life. That was a box check for me. I finally, after a long, finally got to go to Gen Con.
Yeah, it was fun for me to go with you. I thought that you were going to be sort of more excited, but you seemed more sort of not let down.
It was fine. It's just that I should have done it when I was younger.
I had a super great time.
Yeah.
I was like, look at all these people dressed as elves. This is amazing. It was generally a great time for me. But my favorite part was when we did a dance party.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody was dressed up. I mean, I don't remember if you and I dressed up.
No, we didn't.
But there was there ended up being this moment where a couple of people got on each other's shoulders.
And they were going to have a chicken fight, and the whole crowd started chanting.
Chicken fight. And then a couple of the guys who were on the shoulder started murmuring something. And then the chant changed to bad idea. Yeah. It was great. I think it was a chicken fight between Honey Badger and
Nixon.
Deadpool.
Oh, it was Deadpool.
Yeah,
okay.
I believe so. Yeah. At any rate, that has nothing to do with this
with
book.
This at all. Yeah, that's just Indiana. That's what we know.
That's what we know of Indiana. This author, however, has a deep knowledge
of Indiana.
Bruce Snyder grew up there, and his autobiographical attachment to this particular place is very clear throughout. There's so many just luminous details throughout the entire book. There's specificity all over this book. So I wanted to introduce this poem to you.
Mm-hmm. And it's about Indiana?
Yep.
Okay.
But let me tell you a little bit about Bruce. about his accolades.
Okay.
Okay, so Bruce Snyder is an American poet originally from rural Indiana, mm-hmm. as I mentioned. He's an associate professor at the University of San Francisco.
Okay.
Snyder held a Wallace Stegner Fellowship in Creative Writing at Stanford University and was also the Jenny McLean Moore Writer in Residence at George Washington University.
Bi-coastal.
Yeah. His collections, which draw mostly on his Midwestern upbringing, include The Year We Studied Women, which is the winner of the Felix Pollack Prize in Poetry, and also this collection, Paradise, Indiana, which was the recipient of the Lena Mize Weaver Todd Poetry Prize, also with the University of Wisconsin Press. He also, with the poet Shar Leslie, co-edited an anthology of essays called The Poem's Country, Place, and Poetic Practice. And I'm going to draw a little bit from that during this show.
We've done her. She's the explosive expert's wife.
Yeah, the explosive expert's wife. That's Shar Leslie. And there's a really nice summary of this book on the Poetry Foundation website that I just wanted to read out. In Paradise, Indiana, Snyder depicts the experience of growing up gay in a small town and frankly addresses absence and loss, acknowledging the ordinary details of rural life and complicated loves. The collection is threaded with elegiac poems for a cousin. James Cruz, reviewing the book for The Rumpus, noted, "Snyder is a master of the quiet moment, his memory-driven narratives slowly unfolding until the accumulation becomes a kind of redemption." And I really agree with Cruz's description here. I mean, one of the things I really like about the collection, as I mentioned before, as a whole, and this poem in particular, is its kind of accumulation of specificity.
Mm-hmm.
So that the power of these little details all rolled up together in one poem or one book creates a kind of brilliant entirety,
mm-hmm.
that makes the whole of these mundane details feel somehow transcendent. And I wanted to introduce this effect by looking at the very first poem in the collection, which is simply titled Map.
Okay. And that's this today's?
Yes,
okay.
Today's poem. So this poem is in a form that requires particular thematic and linguistic considerations. So as I read through, I just want you to try to pay attention to the patterns.
The patterns?
Yeah.
Notice visual patterns or sound? What am I?
Any kind of repetition.
Okay.
That's usually what you're looking for when you're looking for patterns in poems. Because I wanted to see how much you could glean from this particular form before introducing it overtly.
Okay. If you want to read along with the poem, just go to our website, litfromthebasement.com, click on the show notes tab along the top, and then scroll to the show title with the poem's name. The most recent show is always on top, and this is show number 41.
Map by Bruce Snyder. There ought to be a fire somewhere in Indiana, not this night across the fields in Indiana. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be corn, and there was Indiana. I kiss my love, taking his hand near the deer stand. Honey is fragrant on the table, and there is thunder in Indiana. And what of Amy Blaine, who drowned when she was 12? Nights, I feel her in the cold rain of Indiana. For the rest of my life, I'll feel the wet hair plastered to her face. I'll feel darkness and the magpie's feathers in Indiana. But I'm not interested in grief, just the sound of the yellow throat, just the warblers in the thickets of Muncie, Indiana. I don't need a communion wafer. I need the autumn mist of Indiana. Arcola, Goshen, Napanee. Remember a place where the riverbank passes through you, where the Amish girls spread their skirts in Indiana. Remember a place where spring breaks the yellow news of the pawpaw tree, where a pan of grease hisses against a flame called Indiana. Lord, the boys touch each other, eating fried dough and glazed apples, lips sticky with syrup and heat in Indiana. Each winter, sleet turns the cornfield into a cemetery. Its epitaph reads, Indiana. My father's pulse slows between systole and diastole, between the frozen creek beds and the grain silos of Indiana. And you will ask, where are the lilacs? And I will answer, under the snows of Indiana. Soon, spring buds will thrust their sex organs into the mouths of bees. Their story is the story of Indiana. If there are 100 ways to recall the dogwood in bloom, this is the one where your parents make love on a battered sofa in Indiana. Stamen and pistil, pollen in the air, the field of poppies knows lust spells its name, I-N-D-I-A-N-A. What's death, after all, if not the Wabash wearing down river stones, if not the muskrat flicking its damp tail in Indiana? Are those angels' trumpets? Is that God calling, Bruce? Have I reached the end of the world or Indiana?
Okay, I got one of the reoccurring things easy enough.
Right.
Indiana.
Of course.
But I'm guessing also the seasons change, because he mentions autumn, but then when he's talking about his father, he's saying frozen creek beds and grain silos. So that's winter, because they've stored the food. I wasn't paying enough attention to if there were other glimpses of summer.
Oh, there definitely were. What about the fried dough? And
well, when I was reading, Lord, the boys touch other boys eating fried dough, apple glaze. I'm like, oh, Mike Pence. He's probably all a flush when he hears that.
Yeah, probably so. But your observation is excellent. It's not part of the form, but yeah, there is. It feels like there's a whole year. Mm-hmm. In the poem.
Yeah.
Spring also breaks its news, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yellow news, like it, with the pawpaw tree.
Oh.
There's a whole year that happens in the poem. That's part of mm-hmm. the sort of organic cohesion of these couplets. Yeah. So he's working in actually a quite an ancient form. The form is called the American pronunciation. It's an ancient Arabic form.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. The American pronunciation, people usually call it a guzzle.
Oh, we did one of these for Lorca.
Yes, that's exactly. I'm so happy that you remember.
Because it had such a distinct name.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you might recall that when we were talking about.
The thing was like, it was around a Halloween show.
Yeah, it was, I think, it was our Halloween show.
The Gazelle of Dark
Death.
Yeah,
we did Lorca's Gacela de la Muerte Oscura. That's just Gacela of the Dark Death. Gacela is the Spanish variant of the word guzzle.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's the American pronunciation, but the Arabic pronunciation, which I cannot speak any Arabic, but it's much closer to like Ghazal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's actually spelled Ghazal.
Mm-hmm. So it's got a lot of like glottal sound to it, probably.
Yeah, yeah, and it also sounds sort of softer. Like it's not guzzle, which is basically what the American tradition is.
Now I do not remember what that is.
Yeah, no,
I just remember the word.
Well, because the Spanish variant of it is very different from the American.
Mm.
So this form actually originated in 7th century Arabia, but over the centuries, it's been adopted by poets of many cultures and in many languages, mm-hmm. right? Hindi, Turkish, Hebrew, German, you know, Lorca, obviously Spanish.
Yeah.
Its adoption into English is really pretty recent.
Mm-hmm.
English-speaking poets didn't really start working in the form until 1960.
Oh.
Yeah. and Americans didn't really start to pay attention to the form until the poet Aga Shahid Ali published an anthology of ghazals in American English in the year 2000.
Oh, okay.
So that anthology is called Ravishing Disunities, Real Guzzles in English. And that was the one that really introduced people to this particular form, which everybody kind of went crazy for.
So the form, it's when you call two things couplets, right?
Yes.
Okay. So
it's always in couplets.
Okay. What else? What are some other hallmarks?
There are
always homoerotic.
No.
The 7th century Arabs were way into that.
No. But they are often erotic.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they are more often expressions of religious ecstasy.
Okay.
For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Map by Bruce Snyder. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Just click on the show notes tab and look for show number 41. But yeah, the couplets are exactly right. So it's a minimum of five couplets. That's two-line stanzas for those of you who maybe just tuned in. And typically, it's no more than 15 stanzas of couplets.
Okay.
Each couplet are sort of structurally and thematically and emotionally autonomous. So the
from the rest?
Each other.
Oh, each line is from each other. Couplet
is. So that is to say that there's no like through-line narrative in a couplet. As the couplets are supposed to be kind of treated separately from each other, almost as if you have one big poem made up of a bunch of separate little couplets.
Okay.
Couplet poems.
Okay.
Like, so the idea is you could lift out any of the couplets and they would sort of stand on their own. They would have enough tension. They would have enough imagery.
Wow, that's putting a lot of pressure.
It is a lot of pressure. So in the Persian tradition, each couplet was of the same meter and length, and the subject matter included either, like I said, erotic longing or religious belief, mysticism. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, the English poets don't use meter when writing in this form, but they do often take these themes of erotic or religious ecstasy. Mm-hmm. And in this poem, obviously, you can see both.
Yeah.
So you'll notice that the first couplet, both lines end on the same word, Indiana, this case. And in all previous couplets, only the second line ends on that word. And so that's called the radif, which is the repeating word or phrase that happens twice in the first couplet and then once for all additional couplets.
That's called what?
The radif.
When that happens, it's called a radif.
Yeah, and that's part of the form of the poem.
How do you spell that?
R-A-D-I-F.
Radif. Okay.
In more strict practitioners, this repeating phrase is preceded by the couplet's rhyming word. So, but that doesn't happen in this particular poem. So if you didn't pick up on that, that's not necessarily something that all American and or English speaking poets do when they're using this particular form.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a true through line of this particular poem, although I do find the inconsistent rhyme in this kind of pleasurable and sort of adding to the autonomous nature of each of the couplets, which I can talk about later.
Okay, yeah, I was going to need some points of things out to me.
It comes in and it goes away, adding some sort of surprise to the sonic texture of the poem, which I really like.
It's rhyming whack-a-mole.
Yeah, kind of. And the other really kind of fun and quirky thing of a ghazal or a guzzle is that... in the final couplet of the poem, the poet is required to refer to themselves, sometimes in first person, sometimes in third person, right? And frequently poets do this by using their own name or some derivation of its meaning. So if I were writing like one of these bad boys, I could end it with the line, Danielle can't even pronounce Chazal, right? Or since Danielle means God is my judge, maybe the ending could be, and God says, I judge you, poet. For your pronunciation of Chazal. but you have to sneak your name in there at the end, which I find kind of wonderful. It's a wonderful and kind of quirky aspect of this particular form. So let's start with the title.
Okay.
So he's working within this, along this tradition and in this form.
Mm-hmm.
One of the hardest things about this form, of course, is that you have to repeat yourself over and over and over in every single couplet. Each of the couplets have to sort of stand on their own to be sort of have enough tension in of themselves to create a poem.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to repeat yourself constantly in a way that doesn't feel repetitive and terrible to your reader.
Or you can make it, you can just really make it hooky, like just put a hook in it. And for me, what helped was I just kept imagining Elvis singing in the ghetto every time it says in Indiana.
Is that what you did?
I was much more amused at that point.
But the poem starts with the word map.
Mm.
And I like the openness of this particular title. We expect an emphasis on place.
Yeah.
Because of it. We don't know what's being mapped here at the beginning. It's clear, I think, probably by the very first stanza, right? Because two references to Indiana.
Yeah.
But I think that we come to understand that it's really the speaker's relationship to place itself, which is, of course, made up not only of particular locations, but also his experiences there.
Mm-hmm.
And we're oriented at this place in the very first couplet here. There ought to be a fire somewhere in Indiana, not this night across the fields in Indiana.
I know we're in Indiana, but beyond that, I'm kind of okay.
Well, what are the sort of like the implications of such statements?
Well, it's the not this night. There ought to be a fire somewhere, but not this night.
Night across the fields in Indiana. Clearly the speaker feels like Indiana should be burning.
Oh, okay, that's what I'm like. Okay.
Right? Or that it is burned into his mind, perhaps. Mm-hmm. There's this calm coolness of the night doesn't accurately depict his feelings for the place.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what I see is not what should be here.
Okay. So I'm like, I just didn't know if it was me bringing my normal negative malice to a read, but.
Well, what's so interesting about this poem to me is its contradiction in relation to the place. Like, throughout the book, too, like the speaker isn't trashing Indiana.
No.
Like that doesn't happen. Like there's so much attention to detail and I feel like love.
Oh, you
for
mean
this
the book?
Place.
Sorry, I thought the poem. I'm like, he's not trashing. Okay.
No, not in the poem either. Like not in this particular poem and not in any of the poems. Like I don't come across the poems and I'm like, wow, this person really hates Indiana. No, I come across the poems. I'm like, this person loves Indiana or this person has loved many people in Indiana. Like there's like a kind of swollen heart happening for Indiana throughout all of these poems. But they don't pretend that it's the greatest place in the world. They're just like, this is where I come from is the sort of conversation that seems to be happening here. But despite that, you know, that it's complicated, that the loves are complicated. Of course, burning could be both yearning and a desire for destruction. And it sort of begins the contradiction of the book there, like both wanting to escape the place and also loving the place, right? Which is really an interesting dichotomy that's placed throughout the poem, and I'd say the book as a whole. So it's a really nice start to the book. And then we get to the second stanza.
Which now we know, okay, there's going to be a little bit of humor.
Yes. Yeah. I love this. I love this one. It's such a lovely surprise. Like, even though I know that the form is going to require him to end on Indiana, you know, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be corn, and there was Indiana. So, you know, so Indiana is you know, it's often associated with the evangelical brand of Christianity, right? So it would make sense that the second couplet would mention God in relation to this place. But here you also see the speaker's sense of humor and the first of what will be many direct and indirect references to corn throughout the poem. So directly after this mention of God, of course, we get a mention of romance.
Yeah. In a deer stand.
I know.
the whole election cycle, my first thought was Mayor Peter Buttigieg from Indiana.
Yeah.
Because he talked about hunting in the deer stand with his husband. And I'm like,
yeah.
What is it about
what about deer stands?
Yeah.
I don't know. You're alone. You're hunting together.
Let's be really manly.
Yes.
Let's be manly and just exclude women and everything.
Well, there's the kiss near the deer stand, right? In the next stanza, I kiss my love, taking his hand, which isn't what we usually think of as classic literary romance. Like, I don't think there's ever been a time in my life when I was reading a book and a couple were walking toward a deer stand and I thought, oh, I know what's coming next.
Yeah.
Right? Like now at this point, the speaker's gender isn't necessarily revealed. That won't be revealed entirely until to the end of the poem, but we get the introduction of the theme of desire here, and desire in a rural landscape, right? I kiss my love, taking his hand near the deer stand, and then honey is fragrant on the table, and there is thunder in Indiana.
Which, as we know, honey and thunder are never associated with passion or anything. They are not sensuous. As when you see dripping honey and lightning in the background, it is not sexual at all. It actually means...
Yeah, especially in a poem, right? Like,
right.
There probably was just literally honey and there was thunder.
Yeah.
Yeah, the sort of electricity and the accumulation.
Sweetness.
Sticky sweet and accumulation of electricity leading to some thunderous downpour, right? It's very, yeah, it's quite beautiful.
It just meant that some hair metal band was playing in the background. Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard was playing. And
possibly.
Yes, from somebody's like T-top Camaro. That is absolutely in
Sexy.
Indiana.
You know, I mean, I don't find this to be, you know, incredibly far away from sort of the moments of adolescence generally. Mm-hmm. Like, there's all this stuff about literature and movies and things about like first romance or first sex, and always, you know, they're depicted extremely romantically. Yeah. In that, like, they're always like their first kiss is like they're caught in a downpour and, you know, I don't know, wherever.
Right. Airport terminal.
But I find that doesn't match any of my like experiences, you know, as an adolescent, mm-hmm. right? Or even in my early years, like usually it happened in some awkward place to have your first kiss. And, you know, the kiss itself was awkward.
Yeah.
And these sorts of things. But I'm not saying that this kiss is necessarily awkward. It seems like there's a little bit of confidence
right.
happening there. But it is happening at a deer stand, which is not like classic
yeah,
romance.
We're just going to go hunting.
See,
you guys,
and,
like,
and,
we've
and
been
just
gone
see
many
what
hours.
Yeah.
Like, wow.
Just, let's just see what happens.
What a great excuse.
And then we get
less jokey.
Oh, much less jokey and much less.
Well, I mean, maybe people do find the next subject funny, but
yeah, but we probably don't like those people. Yeah. So, and what of Amy Blaine, who drowned when she was 12? Nights I feel her in the cold rain of Indiana.
Yeah, that's a somber turn.
Yeah. For sure. So, I mean, that this is one of the pleasures of the ghazal, is that you can do that in this. Like,
oh,
it's,
you're right, because it's disjointed.
Tonally,
it's
exactly.
It's, oh, okay.
It's can be tonally dissonant with regard to the way that each couplet is speaking to one another, because mm-hmm. they're not supposed to speak to one another
right.
specifically. Like, you do have a through theme of some kind, just because otherwise, I mean, like I said, it's usually based on erotic or religious love.
But we think the honey is fragrant on the table. There's thunder in Indiana, so we know it's warmer. There's probably a thunderstorm happening. And then we switch to, I guess, a different season. It's nighttime, it's darker, and it's cold.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And you're bringing up a proper name of a person, right, who I don't know. So I tried to look up Amy Blaine to see if she was some kind of famous drowning, and nothing came up that I could find. So I assume this is simply the tragedy of the death of a young girl that has burned itself into the mind of the speaker at an early age.
Same middle school they went together. Or,
yeah, something like that.
Or it was a cautionary tale. Don't go swimming in that, you know, that rock quarry. Remember what happened to Amy Blaine?
In these first four stanzas, right, we're introduced to the four most prominent themes in the poem. The first is the landscape of Indiana plays. The second is God.
Mm-hmm.
The third is romance. And the fourth is loss. Mm. And that loss usually indicates a death or a coming death. And as I mentioned in the very opening of this, there are a bunch of elegiac poems in this collection. There are several indications in these first lines that tell us about the really complex relationship that the speaker has mm-hmm. to this place, right? You've got like what you assume is young love, you've got religious ecstasy, and you've got like fear and loss and early death, right? Nights I feel her in the cold rain of Indiana. And of course you get that great rhyme between Amy Blaine and rain.
Oh, okay.
Happening there. And that doesn't happen in each of the stanzas, but it feels quite natural for mm-hmm. for that to occur there. The sort of sonic echo of
yeah,
Blaine with
rain. Well, so natural went right past me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is what it is. So there are several moments where you get rhyme happening throughout the poem. It happens in the middle. It's internal. And so you tend not to notice it as much.
Mm-hmm.
And he already has the repeating Indiana throughout the poem as required by the form. So you probably wouldn't want to have like an extreme rhyme.
Mm-hmm. For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Map by Bruce Snyder. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can go to our website, litfromthebasement.com. Click on the show notes tab and look for show number 41.
So then we get the next couplet. For the rest of my life, I'll feel the wet hair plastered to her face. I'll feel darkness and the magpie's feathers in Indiana. I mean, this seems like a clear, actual extension of the couplet before.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
It's clear that the speaker will forever associate the drowning of this girl with his hometown.
Yeah.
Right? And I love the use of magpies here, not only because of the specificity, you'll find magpies in Indiana, but also because of their association, since magpies are notorious thieves.
The thieving magpie.
Yes, that's exactly right. So they rob the eggs from other birds' nests, right? Mm. Essentially robbing them of their children. Right? And of course, you know, wings and feathers have the Christian association of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
I can almost see this in a painting, like a girl with wet hair plastered to her face with like a flock of magpies flying all around her. Mm. And then it goes on. And this, there is an extension of grief here, but he immediately turns it, right? But I'm not interested
in grief. Yeah.
Just the sound of the yellow throat.
So a different bird. That's a bird, right?
Uh-huh.
Okay, so we go to a different bird.
Just the warblers in the thicket of Muncie, Indiana. And as we know, I love Muncie. So this one resists any mention of the divine that one could have after mentioning death, right?
Well, he literally mentioned God in the second.
I'm talking about this couplet.
Oh, got you. Okay.
Right, we're thinking of the couplets as separate.
Okay, gotcha.
Yeah. So in the couplet before, you know, you have an almost a picture of kind of Christian or religious death,
mm-hmm.
with the magpie's feathers going on and the girl being dead. And then this next couplet reverses that. It's really focusing on the physical reality of the yellow throat, the warblers. And the next stanza does this as well, but in a larger and kind of more philosophical manner. I don't need a communion wafer. I need the autumn mist of Indiana. And this is one of these moments where, again, I feel like I can feel the speaker's love of the place that they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
Because, of course, the communion wafer is how you're saved. You know, you ingest the body of Christ so that you're sort of like renewing the covenant that you have with the Creator, and or, you know, you take it in a sort of act of belief or faith in something. But this speaker is actually refusing that. I don't need a communion wafer. I need the autumn mist of Indiana. And there's also so much like nostalgia and longing here. Like to compare the autumn mist of Indiana with a communion wafer, he needs it more than he needs religion, right? That the place has become, in some sense, a place of worship, in that it is itself worshipped by the speaker.
It'd also be like the mists of Avalon. Like,
yeah,
this is,
oh, interesting.
Through the mist is my ideal land.
Yeah, I need the autumn mist of Indiana. Like, that's what makes me feel whole, much more than these actions, right? Which is so great. And then, of course, after that, I need the autumn mist of Indiana. Then you get the mention of so many places.
Mm-hmm. So now we're getting to a map.
Exactly. Arcola, Goshen, Napanee. I'm probably mispronouncing all of these places.
Now, if we map those out, does it form a pattern?
Oh my gosh, I didn't think to do that. We should put a map of Indiana on our show notes and see if we can draw. Yeah. Is there a triangle here? In the Bermuda Triangle, in the Indiana Triangle.
No, it just came up to be a smiling cyclops when I dotted it out. We'll find out. We'll put the map up in the show notes.
Yeah, for sure. So there's the mention of all these specific places. And then remember a place where the river bank and then line break passes through you, which I love.
Mm.
Comma, where the Amish girls spread their skirts in Indiana.
Yeah, which almost, you start to think, oh wait, no, that's totally chaste. Everything about that, it starts to like spread, oh, skirts, not legs, gotcha. Okay.
Right.
And you just see them like kind of like spreading out modestly, sitting down on the grass of the banks.
Yes, that's exactly right. There's something about that that does sort of begin to hint at some kind of sexuality, but then it doesn't, mm-hmm. right? Like, it's clearly just like they're spreading, like, yes, that they're like sitting along the bank is what I imagined also. And of course, you know, if you're going to be naming particular places in Indiana, mentioning a bit of the cultural relevance of those places by referring to the Amish, which have some large population in that particular part of the country. And then remember a place where spring breaks the yellow news of the pawpaw tree, where the pan of grease hisses against a flame called Indiana. That's amazing. I love this line so much.
I did when I'm like, okay, where? What's the panhandle of Indiana? I'm like, oh, wait, there isn't one. Is there a panhandle near Indiana? Nope, Chicago doesn't have one.
Oh, really?
One.
You, yeah, like, you immediately thought of Indiana?
Well,
or
no,
a panhandle?
I'm like, you know, the geography, is there a panhandle there?
I think it's just a rectangle, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Most of the Midwest is.
Yeah, yeah. So, but I love the surprise of that line. Mm. Never in my life have I thought of a state name as a flame against which a pan of grease hisses,
yeah.
Right? Like, that's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that was, you know what? It's one of those things I'm like, I couldn't tell you what it means, but I kind of dig it.
Yeah.
It resonates with me,
yeah,
for reasons I can't say.
Well, I mean, it
or
probably,
articulate.
Well, it probably resonates if for no other reason than the surprise of it, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
And this is one of the difficulties of getting this form right? To come to Indiana over and over and over again, you better find some way to surprise us.
Right.
And this is a total surprise. You know, I love the surprise of these lines. The yellow news of the tree, I also really like. And the flame called Indiana is the melting pan of grease. And this has to do partly with, like, the kind of cooking that you might find in this particular place. But also, it goes back to that idea of heat or burning that is established in the very first couplet. There is a kind of rhetorical echo happening here.
Mm.
There ought to be a fire in Indiana. Right. And then here that Indiana actually becomes a fire.
Yeah.
A flame. And then, of course, you know, this is against a pan of grease. And then the next couplet, I mean, you've got some fried dough that you could put in that pan. Right. But beginning.
There's all kinds of sizzling in the next
line.
Yeah,
there's many kinds of sizzling. Lord, the boys touch other boys eating fried dough and glazed apples, lips sticky with syrup and heat in Indiana. Oh my.
Yeah. Ooh. Again, Mike Pence just fainted.
Or clutched his pearls. as you often say. So, you know, these lines are clearly homoerotic.
Right.
Maybe perhaps combative by the mention of Lord at the start of the line.
Mm-hmm.
But it could also just be a use of colloquialism, like Lord knows we need more cooking grease. But it could also be simply informing the Lord of the situation, right? Lord,
he's informing
yeah.
on them. Lord, Lord, look, Lord.
Lord, you should know. but any way that you
there's
look
some
at
hot dough eating going on.
Hot, sticky, fried dough. And any way you look at it, the speaker is placing sexual desire and religious connotation in one sentence,
mm-hmm.
which in Christianity is usually seen as antithetical to one another. Sex founded in the body and religion, or founded in the spirit.
Yeah.
Right. So I really like the poet's sly use of philosophical contradiction in those lines. Like, he could have just said, the boys touch other boys eating fried dough, etc. Putting Lord at the beginning of it, like, ups the ante a bit. It, like, creates more tension in the poem. So then you go to the next stanza. Each winter, sleet turns the cornfield into a cemetery. Its epitaph reads Indiana.
So corn husks, dead corn is Indiana.
Oh, that's actually wonderful. I hadn't necessarily considered that.
What do you think it was?
I guess I was just I was thinking about how the author is describing the seasons throughout, and of course the dead of winter. But the speaker is also aligning the whole of Indiana with a cemetery.
Mm.
Like, I went to the sort of metaphorical representation rather than the literal, but the literal is beautiful. There's a lot of elegiac poetry happening throughout the
mm-hmm.
book, and obviously it's happening throughout this poem as well. There's actually a poem in the collection called At the Midwest Taxidermy Convention.
Okay. Show that to me off the clock.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to have to. But its epitaph reads Indiana, right? But I love your description, or your thinking of the actual, like, either shorn fields or at least the corn husks, the dead corn
mm-hmm.
sort of left as a kind of cemetery.
Well, I was just thinking about how pathetic our little garden looks when
I yeah.
into the winter, I still had left those corn stalks up. Like, that's just depressing.
Yeah,
I imagine
yeah,
a whole state of that.
Yeah, I know. But probably they don't do that, right? Like, probably they cut them down. But still, that these each of the corn stalks create a kind of tombstone.
Mm-hmm.
From there to my father's pulse slows between, and I don't know, I kept looking up the pronunciation of these two words, actually. Systole and diastole. Or systole. There were different English pronunciation as opposed to American pronunciation, mm-hmm. and I couldn't quite decide. But and then between the frozen creek beds and the grain silos of Indiana.
So we're absolutely in winter. I mean, he said winter previously, but now we're talking. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. We're staying with winter for a while. So the normal rhythmical contraction of the heart is the systole, during which the blood is in the chambers, is forced onward. Oh. And then diastole, the phase of the heartbeat when the heart muscle relaxes and allows the chamber to fill with blood.
Mm.
So there's this sense of perhaps oncoming death happening in this. And then between the frozen creek beds and the grain silos of Indiana are both clearly images of at least a kind of hibernation. There's stasis and a quiet and cold happening. And then we jump into what feels like spring.
Hmm.
It's moving through the seasons.
But it seems like spring is kind of like hope delayed. Hey, where are the lilacs? Oh, they're still under the snow.
Yeah.
They're there. There's hope. There's relife. Yeah. There's life born anew.
Right. Under the snows of Indiana. Like someday the cemetery is going to come to a life, but not right now.
Yeah.
And then soon spring buds will thrust their sex organs into the mouths of bees.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. Which is not how I've ever thought of that exchange. Yeah. Their story is the story of Indiana. Yeah. There's a really interesting reversal here. The command of the plants instead of the insects, which obviously can move. But it goes to show, too, the sort of like liveliness of the landscape itself. Like if we're thinking of these buds as being sort of part of the land, that the insects or birds or anything that might be pollinators and by extension, we think about humans,
mm-hmm.
right, are inextricably drawn to the land in a way that they're almost forced to be. Like they can't turn away from it. Right.
And the, I guess the big surprise here is that that young budding plants are tops and bees are bottoms.
Yes. Yeah. Which is not what anybody would
That's
have ever
a novel
thought.
Take.
For sure. But there actually are larger philosophical ideas surrounding, like, humans believe that they are manipulating these plants and plant lights for agriculture use or for beauty or whatever, when those are actually also evolutionary.
Yeah, we're a selecting force of evolution.
Right, but also those plants are also selecting, right? Like they're like, oh, I'm going to survive by making the humans like me. Great.
Okay. I'll pander to them.
Yeah, totally. Oh, they're going to plant rows and rows and rows of me, miles of me.
Just
sure.
Because I do this.
Yeah.
Got it.
And then if there are 100 ways to recall the dogwood in bloom, this is the one where your parents make love on a battered sofa in Indiana. And then the next couplet right next to it, stamen and pistil, pollen in the air, the field of poppies knows lust, spells its name, Indiana, I-N-D-I-A-N-A. So
stamen and pistil.
Pollen in the air. Clearly you've got spring and the dogwood in bloom, the parents making love on a battered sofa, and then lust in the air. Like there seems to be like an associative leap to like consummation generally, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Which makes me think this sort of scene of the parents making love on a battered sofa is like the conception of the speaker.
Which seems to be like if you got a person
yeah.
talking about their parents having sex, it's kind of, I think the like easy that, jump is to, well, you're thinking about your own conception.
Which is kind of interesting, right? Like, and I don't think that people...
Is that us just being too puritanical? Like, well, if he's even discussing this, it must be at a remove. I mean, it's only solely for his own creation. Yeah. I mean, is it...
I think that generally, like, we would think about that because nobody else would be concerned with, right? Like one is generally not concerned with one's parents having sex.
Mm-hmm.
The only time that one imagines it is in imagining their conception.
Yeah.
Like that's the only sort of socially acceptable.
I'm here,
so yeah. They must have had sex at some point.
Yeah. Our kids will know at one point that we've at least
had
sex twice. Yeah.
Exactly. So there's conception and consummation happening all over these poems, and then like there's
it's
lust
all over this poem,
lust and agriculture and the landscape of Indiana, right? Like I've never thought of it as such a sexy place, but it apparently really is. And then we get what's death after all, and this is a big shift
in
tone. What's death after all, if not the Wabash wearing down river stones, if not the muskrat flicking its damp tail in Indiana? And I love this too, also for a surprise, right? Death is a kind of attrition, like wearing mm-hmm. down the mm-hmm. river stones. And so it becomes a kind of unthinking habit, as is represented also by the damp tail of the muskrat flicking, right?
No, this is the first time ever that I've seen or heard of a muskrat being used even remotely as a herald of death.
I know. Or yes.
When you think of like creatures that would be on the Grim Reaper or near that personification of death, muskrat doesn't cut top 30.
Totally. Yeah. Nobody's like, and then the
viper or the vulture.
And then the muskrat. heralds apocalyptic landscape with the flick of its tail.
Behold, the swimming river rat approaches.
Yeah, so it's a natural phenomenon, obviously, that's out of our control. Mm-hmm. But you're exactly right. The surprise in this is like, wait, the muskrat
is just an agent of this river. It's just one other aspect of it.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So the speaker identifies death in an Indiana specific imagery mm-hmm. here. It's telling, which is really telling of the speaker's sort of perception. Like, it's not some river, it's the Wabash, mm-hmm. and it's not some animal, but the muskrat. For the radio listeners who are just tuning in, you're listening to Lit from the Basement with Danielle and Max. The poem we're discussing today is Map by Bruce Snyder. If you'd like to read along with the work, you can find it on our website, litfromthebasement.com. Just click on the show notes tab and look for show number 41. Then directly after this aligning of death with the landscape of Indiana, we get a larger reference of death, like what in the next couplet, right? What some in Christianity will herald the end of the world as we know it from the book of Revelations mm-hmm. With these trumpets, angels. The apocalypse will start when seven trumpets are sounded by seven angels.
Mm-hmm.
You know this, of course.
Oh, I'm very familiar with the apocalyptic death cult of Southern religions. Well, I know this is Midwest, but
yeah, I was going to say different place, but probably similar.
I was taught Revelation before the Beatitudes.
Are you serious? Mm-hmm. That's too bad.
You can see I have issues with religion.
Yeah. So we get the very last couplet here. Mm. Are those angels trumpets? Is that God calling, Bruce? Have I reached the end of the world? You know, full sentence, right? Like question mark. Have I reached the end of the world? Question mark. New sentence or Indiana? Question mark.
Do any other lines have three sentences? Because that's Bruce. Have I reached the end of the world or Indiana?
One, two, three. This has four sentences because it starts with. Oh, just the last.
Just
line.
That last line
oh,
alone.
Yeah. No other line has that. And
there's
ends,
a couple of things with colons, but that's it.
Yeah, but yeah, you're right. It ends with a smattering of question marks.
Yeah,
which I really like. I think that there's been so much contradiction throughout the poem so far. Partly that's just has to do with the form of the tone and jumping around. Also, like contradictory imagery. Is this a great place? Is this a hard place? Is this a place where children die? Is this a place where like boys make out? Like what? Yeah, it's all of those places.
Yeah,
right.
There's lots of religion. And there's lots of naughty. We're just like everywhere else, except we got more corn.
Yeah, exactly. So you see the quirky requirement of the form here at the end, right? That the poet refers to himself in the final couplet.
Mm.
And Snyder decides to do this outright by using his first name. And there's considerable confusion throughout, as indicated by all the question marks. And there's some interesting ambiguity in these final lines. Like, have I reached the end of the world? Question mark, new sentence, or Indiana? So the most literal interpretation, of course, is that the speaker is being called to God. So dying at the apocalyptic end of the world,
mm-hmm.
which originates in Indiana, right? Which some interesting implications for a land that has throughout been associated with God and loss. God plus loss equals Indiana, right? In this poem. One might interpret this as sort of going back to Indiana is death. Or death originates in Indiana, which is not very flattering, except that it's not any death. By placing the start of the apocalypse in Indiana, the speaker infuses it with great importance,
mm-hmm.
right? But death as a symbol is also about change or transformation,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
as it's often represented in tarot readings, which is not associated with this poem at all, but associated in my own mind.
Mm-hmm.
we could think of the sort of end of the world or end of death as being a kind of transformational moment for the speaker.
Like goodbye to all that.
Yes, right? But there are other interpretations. Have I reached the end of the world or Indiana? As in, have I reached the end of the world or just the end of Indiana? Right? Or is this the place of the apocalypse or just Indiana? In other words, Indiana is a hot mess. Like, what is going on here? Is it raining fire and pestilence? No, it's just Indiana is another way that one could interpret it. And then there's a third way, which is the speakers suggesting that going to Indiana always feels like going to the end of the world. Mm. Right? There's an undercurrent here of a kind of emotional apocalypse, that going to Indiana isn't just visiting his past, but that going there means becoming the past.
Wonder if Amy Blaine, who drowned, she drowned in the Wabash.
Did she? Hmm.
No, I'm wondering.
I'm wondering too.
If that's why we come back to the death.
Oh, right. Yeah, maybe. I mean, there's a lot of mentions of rivers here, right? Mm. And I guess my assumption is...
I just assumed it's Midwest. It must have been in a rock quarry. Just made that... No, wait, they have rivers there. He mentions one and ties it to death.
Yeah, I would think that maybe you're right. Like, who drowned when she was 12? Yeah, we kind of assume it very well could be a river, right?
Yeah, or it could be the Wabash is the Styx and the Muskrat is Karen, the boatman. Or Kyron, however you want to pronounce it.
I think the text is resisting your reading here.
It's a new year, new season.
You know, it also seems to say that for better or for worse, right? The speaker imagines that the first place he will see when he dies is the landscape of Indiana.
Hmm.
That it's so deeply ingrained as home that it's even his soul's home, for better or for worse.
If I die, and what if my consciousness continues? And the first thing I see is Whittier, California. I'll know that it's too late for me to make penance. I'll already know what my judgment is. It won't be great. If I see my hometown.
Yeah. But I just wanted to point out a couple of craft elements here.
Okay.
in the poem. So I mentioned earlier that there's a lot of rhyme in the poem, but it's not consistent. So it's always a surprise when it shows up. But I made a list here of the words that rhyme in neighboring couplets or in couplets themselves.
Okay, so that not necessarily within its own couplet, but...
But right next to one another.
Okay.
Right, so this kind of sonic texture arrives, when it arrives inconsistently, you don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know unless you're scrutinizing the poem and looking for it, but it would sound like this. Night, light, near, dear, Blaine, rain, heat, sleet, silos, snows, there, where. And of course, there's tons of consonants throughout. You get like for, feel, face, feathers, or place, pawpaw, tree, pan. Throughout.
You've got some skills. You're just...
these are pretty standards poet skills. Like literally anybody that I know would be able to point this. But there's
so much...
It's
me bringing a Toyota Corolla to a drag race.
There's also, this is a fun thing, although there's a wide variety of imagery throughout this poem, the poem as a whole is chromatically cohesive. The most prominent color in the poem is yellow.
Corn.
Yellow's all over this poem. We start with corn. We move to the sound of the yellow throat, the yellow news, the pawpaw tree, cornfield, fried dough, grain silos, pollen. Like there's yellow throughout this entire. So the whole thing kind of like has this gold undertone to it. So one thing about this poem that I wanted to bring up and about the work as a whole is that Snyder has an essay in The Poem's Country, Place and Poetic Practice, called Trouble and Consolation, Writing the Gay Rural.
Mm-hmm.
And this...
The role?
Writing the Gay Rural.
Oh, rural. Gotcha. Okay.
The Rural Juror. So, you know, the essay is in part a kind of nuanced analytical discussion of setting or place in queer poetics, and partly... It's a memoir about growing up gay in rural Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
And the essay itself is just gorgeous. The thing I love about Bruce's work is its specificity, as I mentioned before. And you can see that in his prose just as much as his poetry. So it's a truly wonderful essay that I think should be read in its entirety. But I've selected two quotes here that I think are good illustration of the two modes of writing in this essay.
From of his own.
Yes.
Okay.
The first quote comes from early in the essay and has a personal focus, using his own life as sort of anecdotal evidence for what he's discussing, the mm-hmm. gay rural poem.
Mm-hmm.
10 miles outside of town, my family lived on a lake where we snagged bluegill and perch. On my grandparents' nearby farm, we shoveled manure, chopped wood, helped my grandmother churn butter. And some days, I'd get to feed Napoleon, my grandfather's champion market goat. When chores were done, my brothers and I would play in the woods where we built forts, played tree tag, war, hide and seek. I had my first kiss in those woods from a neighbor boy who smelled like wood smoke and wore a t-shirt with a faded iron-on of Darth Vader. We were both 13, safe in the crisscross of shadows cast by the shagbark hickories surrounding us. We never talked about it, but we started sneaking away to meet there, keeping an eye out for his older sister or my little brothers. Leaning against a rusted-out wheelbarrow, we never thought about where we were, but if we closed our eyes, we'd have noticed the whir of mosquitoes above our heads and woodpeckers knocking the trees and the constant churning of my grandfather's tiller far beyond us in the back acre. And again, it's the specificity. It's not we caught fish. It's we snagged bluegill and perch. Yeah. It's not we felt safe in the woods. It's safe in the crisscross of shadows cast by the shagbark hickories surrounding us.
Yeah.
Yes. You can hear the hard K sounds and the soft S sounds in this phrase, that they keep trading places in the words crisscross shadows cast shagbark hickories, which is just so lovely. And also that those are the two most prominent sounds that form the word kiss.
Oh, wow. See, you're game.
It's,
yeah.
I mean,
that's why you're the host.
It's so beautiful. You know, and this is a line of prose, and it's not even, you know, necessarily a poem. So it's so good. But the other aspect I really like in this passage is the way that homosexual desire is hidden in the rural landscape. Literally with the veil of the hickories, but also in the sort of heteronormative expectations of the land and the people. And this is what he talks about in the essay, is that he grew up feeling both close to the place where he lived and also quite aware that it seems that, according to the literature that he read, that gay culture only happened in rural, in urban landscapes.
Yeah.
Which brings me to the second quote. The second quote has an analytical focus and references an anthology on rural American writing, which was edited by David Pichaski, which Snyder read as an undergraduate student, he tells us in the essay, noting that it was conspicuously absent of anyone that he could have identified as gay.
Yeah.
I mean, he probably, you know, took the class just sort of thinking about rural writing. But he goes on to say, although I understood Pichaski was arguing for a rural literature defined in part by generalized moral virtue that was itself rooted in American nationalism, I couldn't help but wonder if the omission of gay voices in his rural canon gestured toward a more pointed claim that the moral glory of American countryside somehow prevented, or at least denied, the existence of gay men and women. And yet I'd grown up in a world much like those described by the anthology's authors. So the moral glory that Snyder talks about here, that is the moral ideology yoked to a particular landscape, is really deeply rooted in even the very beginnings of America's idea of itself. So one of the ways that early Americans define themselves against England specifically and Europe more generally, in an attempt to create a kind of identity that wasn't predicated on lack, that is, early America didn't have a tradition of grand architecture or symphonies or even literature. But in reading early American texts, you can see that Americans clearly feel insecure about this.
Yeah.
And I got a lot of this thinking, by the way, from a book by David E. Nye titled The American Sublime. But the way that Americans identified themselves as purists, European Americans anyway, purists, and identified themselves with the landscape. So that the landscape became a kind of, had a kind of religious heft in of itself. Like, you may have grand buildings, but we have the Rockies, right? Or we have, you know,
the Columbia River Gorge.
Right. I mean, or I'm trying to think of more Eastern.
Well,
or we have the Mississippi, right? Something to that extent. And so this goes like way back in American idea of itself. But interestingly, early America and poetry is most commonly associated with Walt Whitman,
mm-hmm.
who is considered the father of American poetry.
Uh-huh.
And he wanted to incorporate everything into his work. The sexuality of Whitman
mm-hmm.
Is still speculated by biographers.
He had, I thought it was a settled thing.
In my mind, it is.
Okay.
I think any poet, their minds, it is. But they don't have hard and fast rules. Partly this
they don't have any hidden daguerreotypes. They didn't find an old shoebox of trinkets left from.
But if you're going merely by his poetry, right? I mean, the first thing I think of, my favorite poem from Whitman's Leaves of Grass is one of the two U's. And he actually says in there, "Whoever you are, now I place my hand upon you, that you be my poem. I whisper with my lips close to your ear. I have loved many women and men, but I love none other better than you," which I love. It's often thought of that Whitman was bisexual.
He just meant the Christian love.
No, he didn't. He definitely did not.
Hot, steamy, sanctioned in the eyes of our Lord Jesus Christ, sex. This is perfectly acceptable action.
Yeah, that's not the tenets of desire. Like, that's not where it starts.
It's so hot how sanctioned and okay this is. I love that there's nothing racy about this.
At all.
No threat. Maintain the status quo.
So we've got women in the American poetic tradition, and he was considered a visionary of his time. Like, mm-hmm. people thought of him as sort of prophetic. The other sort of origin of American poetry is Emily Dickinson, and it's also long been speculated that Emily Dickinson was in love with her sister-in-law, as depicted in a recent movie, Wild Nights with Emily, which I'm really excited to see. Yeah, it looks awesome. I hate movies about writers at all, because there's so many passages or so many scenes of writers sitting and writing and looking thoughtful
or channeling a spirit.
Yeah, something.
It's just that the writing takes over.
But what I'm coming down to is the fact that American poetry, the origin of American poetics, is queer.
Okay.
This is in my mind,
European American.
Yeah, European American poetics, right? Like what people usually think of. But part of the reason why it's speculated and it's difficult to sort of pin down is that actually calling Whitman bisexual or even gay, the sort of the speculative aspect of biographies of this poet have to do with the lack of language of that particular time.
Mm.
Like the word gay as associated with same-sex desire didn't even really exist until the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a fun fact.
Okay.
If you look up the etymology of that meaning of the word in the OED, which is my jam.
Mm-hmm. That's the Oxford English Dictionary.
The origin is actually U.S. slang of a person, homosexual. And the very first entry in the OED is from a book, Geography and Plays, by Gertrude Stein, herself a writer and an out lesbian in the 1920s.
Mm-hmm.
And the entry is this: Helen Furr and Georgina Keene lived together then. They were together then and traveled to another place and stayed there, and they were gay there. Not very gay there, just gay there. They were both gay there. which I love.
So that's how we came to take happy to being homosexual? It was from that line?
No, not necessarily. I think because at that point,
it was getting some currency.
Yeah, if it was in the OED in a written document in 1922, then it'd probably been around for a while. Like it takes a while for slang to get written down, mm-hmm. right? So all I'm saying is that you have these kind of two contradictions, right? You have the overall sort of heteronormative literary canon, which associates landscape with God and religiosity,
mm-hmm.
and you have the poetic tradition of American poetry, which actually has a lot of homoerotic elements to it in at least its founding origins. And obviously, both poets are greatly loved and celebrated. I think we don't have any more time. I have a whole other, you guys, I just counted up all of the pages that I've been writing for this podcast and they're completely raw and not at all. I can't publish them anywhere. And it comes out to 560 double space pages.
It was double spaced. I thought it was
560 double spaced pages, 280 or whatever single spaced pages.
You work
of writing on this podcast.
You guys, I have nothing. like as you hear every other week now, I just quip.
But I have like 4 more pages of discussion on this, which clearly we do not have time for.
Well, let's hear the poem one more time, and then we got to do some house cleaning, some announcements.
Okay, great. Okay.
If you want to read along with the poem, just go to our website, litfromthebasement.com, click on the show notes tab along the top, and just look for the most recent show, and this is show number 41.
Map by Bruce Snyder. There ought to be a fire somewhere in Indiana. Not this night across the fields in Indiana. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be corn, and there was Indiana. I kiss my love, taking his hand near the deer stand. Honey is fragrant on the table, and there is thunder in Indiana. And what of Amy Blaine, who drowned when she was 12? Nights, I feel her in the cold rain of Indiana. For the rest of my life, I'll feel the wet hair plastered to her face. I'll feel darkness and the magpie's feathers in Indiana. But I'm not interested in grief, just the sound of the yellow throat, just the warblers in the thickets of Muncie, Indiana. I don't need a communion wafer. I need the autumn mist of Indiana. Arcola, Goshen, Napanee. Remember a place where the riverbank passes through you, where the Amish girls spread their skirts in Indiana. Remember a place where spring breaks the yellow news of the pawpaw tree, where a pan of grease hisses against a flame called Indiana. Lord, the boys touch each other, eating fried dough and glazed apples, lips sticky with syrup and heat in Indiana. Each winter, sleet turns the cornfield into a cemetery. Its epitaph reads, Indiana. My father's pulse slows between systole and diastole, between the frozen creek beds and the grain silos of Indiana. And you will ask, where are the lilacs? And I will answer, under the snows of Indiana. Soon, spring buds will thrust their sex organs into the mouths of bees. Their story is the story of Indiana. If there are 100 ways to recall the dogwood in bloom, this is the one where your parents make love on a battered sofa in Indiana. Stamen and pistil, pollen in the air, the field of poppies knows lust spells its name, I-N-D-I-A-N-A. What's death, after all, if not the Wabash wearing down river stones, if not the muskrat flicking its damp tail in Indiana? Are those angels' trumpets? Is that God calling Bruce? Have I reached the end of the world, or Indiana?
Do you know if he was out of Indiana when he wrote this?
Yes.
So sometimes you got to get out of a place to see it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that I've been able to write about anything, any kind of autobiographical base of anything I've written, unless I was at least 10 years out.
Yeah.
I don't know why it works for me that way, but it does.
Okay. Well, that's a nice little begin to season 3 for us. For those who don't know, we are no longer doing the shows every Monday. We're going to do them on the 1st and 3rd Monday of every month.
That'll be a little bit more manageable.
Yeah, it'll be a little bit easier on Danielle, as you heard that she's written hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages for the show. She needs a break because she's a working professor.
Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for joining us. Our theme music is by Status Q.
We have links on our homepage for you to subscribe to our show on iTunes and Spotify. You can also subscribe through the Google Play Store.
Our show notes have their own tab on their website. There you can find a copy of the work we discussed, a link to purchase the work, author information, anything else we thought might be relevant, like maybe a map connecting those 3 cities that were named. We'll see if that does anything.
If you have a comment, suggestion, correction, or alternative reading of the work, please send us a message using our contact page.
If you're curious about Danielle's work, you can hear shows on each of her 3 books. Just click on the Vanity Press tab on our website. So, well, I feel a little bit smarter.
And I feel a little bit happier.
We hope you guys do too.
Bye-bye. Otherwise hat. So, and then the next line.
I think the a chance was missed with this whole reoccurring thing.
Why?
At some point it could have said, I was in Diana in Indiana.
In Diana? What is that?
Just being in a woman named Diana.
But the whole poem is homoerotic.
Diana could have been a stage name.
Why?
I just feel like it was a missed opportunity somewhere. Could have been in there.
All right. Well, next time you write a book of poems about Indiana.
If I become a lip sync artist, my stage name will be
Diana in Indiana. Diana
in
Indiana.
Diana Indiana.
Okay. All right.
This whole thing's getting dropped.